You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of December 27th, 2017. And get out that Christmas bib, it's time to chow down on this year's leftovers.
Back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alborn.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games, and we done it.
We survived the year.
Well, technically, we're recording this a few days. A lot could happen in a few days.
That's a very good point.
But we fucking did it. We survived 2017. We weathered the glorious storm of video games in 2017, where just dozens of high quality titles are raining down upon us relentlessly.
Do you feel like we're just going to be disappointed coming into 2018?
I was thinking about that, actually, where it's like, have we peaked?
Well, I mean, you know, our game's over. Are we done? Well, the weird thing, though, is a lot of high quality games came out this last quarter in the year. I could see people, even coming into March, being like, should I pick that up or should I just buy one of these awesome games from last year that's on discount?
And also, some of the games that we even talked about in our Game of the Year podcast take a long time to play, so it could eat into it. But, I mean, remember last year, early on in the year, we had, Persona and
that's true.
Zelda. I mean, there was a bunch of March games that really came in, so who knows? Yeah. But that's a conversation for next week.
That's true.
This week, we are going to talk about the games that we didn't get to talk about on our Game of the Year podcast last week. So the Game of the Year podcast, we each take 3 and 3, and we talk about our favorite games. And then this week, we dig into the fridge and shamefully at midnight, eat a bunch of the stuff that's left over.
That's right, yeah. And there's a lot of games, I think, that we both enjoy that we didn't get to talk about just because, as you said, it was a really good year. There was also a couple games that I played pretty recently that didn't, of course, squeeze into my list because I played them after I basically had settled on my list.
Yeah.
But were pretty interesting games anyway, so I'm excited to talk about them.
So why don't I feel like my list might be a little bit dull because we talked about a lot of the games I played during the year, but maybe you should kick us off and then we'll go from there.
Okay, well, I'll kick us off with one that I know I don't think you've played yet, but we've seen before, and I think we've probably talked about it a little bit on the podcast, and that is Gorogoa.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a game by Jason Roberts. I think it's just one dude, and he's been working on it for like a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's published by Annapurna Interactive, which is they publish movies or whatever, right? They're a movie publisher.
Wait, aren't those the same people that did the like Machinarium and...
I don't know about Machinarium, but they published What Remains of Edith Finch.
Oh, okay.
I think that was their first game that they officially published. They're also publishing Watam next year, Donut County, which is next year, also looks pretty cool, and a bunch of other games. But they're a cool little like indie publisher, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, Amanita, that's what I was thinking of. I know what you're talking about, though.
And so Gorogoa is this really gorgeous art puzzle game, and one of the best ways... I've seen the joy of this game described is that the game makes you feel clever while you appreciate how clever the game is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're unfamiliar with what this is basically a puzzle game in which it's like a slide puzzle game, right? Mm. Like we're all familiar with slide puzzles where there's like four spots and you move squares around to like solve puzzles, right? Usually you're doing it to complete a picture. But in this case, all of the photos are layered in kind of weird, interesting ways. So you might have a one-by-one image of some guy looking out of a window, right? And then if you drag that square to another spot on the grid, the window moves, but the contents of the window, like the image of the outdoors, stays.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is revealed underneath is like a garden, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now that you're in the garden, you can move to the left in the garden. So now you're moving through that physical space through the garden. So there's like a lot of depth to the game that you're experiencing solely on like a flat 2D grid. And then there are puzzles that line up, right? So there's a puzzle where you need to get this guy to climb a ladder. And so he might be climbing a ladder, but then you need to patch the ladder using a railroad that's a zoomed in image of a map on like a subway map.
Yeah.
Right? So that suddenly he's climbing the railroad and then he's coming back down a different ladder to get to a different location.
So it's these portraits that have multi-layered fore and backgrounds and you're zooming in and out to line up. It's like a two-dimensional Escher type puzzle.
Yeah, Escher is a very good example of what the puzzles sort of feel like, right? Yeah. They're very clever in that way that they're all patched together. It's a very short game, and it's very, very beautiful. Mm. But this is like a classic artsy-fartsy, like push the your glasses on your nose indie game, right?
Does it have a story to it?
It does, actually, a little bit, right? So the beginning of the game starts with like this kid looking out of a window, and this like weird beast comes onto the land, and he starts to think about like, I don't know, he goes through some book about like how to seal this beast away, right? That involves going backwards and forwards through time, like collecting a bunch of orbs. And so the entire game is really you collecting all of these orbs, but you jump into the future and see this person as like there's, you know, at one point you can see that the kid falls and then gets stuck in like a wheelchair, and then, you know, the future is basically one of like a devastated landscape if you don't stop this beast. So there's a lot of like a little bit of a storyline about how this demigod is like destroying the world, and you're really sort of breaking the rules of time and logic in order to stop them. Anyway, it's a beautiful game. I played it on the Switch.
I was just gonna ask that because it looks like it's Steam and Switch.
Yeah, so I was interested in playing it on the Switch specifically because I didn't know how long it was. I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll want to play it on the go. I just wanted to see what they did with it. I would actually probably say you're better off playing it on as big of a screen as you can because it's a really beautiful game.
Yeah.
And you want that to, want to listen to the music. It's probably best on Steam when you have a like a mouse to move the screens around instead of using the joystick. The Switch...
Does it use the touchscreen on the Switch?
Yeah, so the Switch in handheld mode does use the touchscreen, which does work pretty well and is pretty cool. The other thing I would say is if you do end up playing this, there's an option to turn off the hints, and I would probably recommend it because the hints basically will, like, you'll see a little radar ping anywhere that you can interact with. If you're using touch instead of a mouse, then you also won't see the mouse sort of change into a shape. So if you really want to test yourself from like a puzzle perspective, you're better off doing that. But really, this is just the type of game you're meant to just experience and let it sort of wash over you and enjoy how clever it is. It's almost more like, did you ever read that kid's book Zoom, where like you zoom in closer and closer and closer, like into a painting, and then the painting's on the beach, and then you're in the glasses of some woman. Like, it feels like you're sort of reading or enjoying the cleverness of like a children's book.
It's cool. I mean, I have heard of it, and... It seemed like one of those. I mean, the title is, I mean, I'm sure this is, that's maybe the demigod or whatever that you're talking about, but I had no clue what this game even was.
Yeah.
And so this is really cool. I would like to play this.
Yeah, it's really neat. I would strongly recommend, or rather, I would say that when we talked about our gamies, this probably would have been the prettiest game, one of the prettiest games of the year awards too. So if anyone is really into like, oh, I'm into really gorgeous games, this is absolutely one of the best of the year.
It's awesome. Yeah. Cool. All right, I will throw one in here. Another Switch game that I've been playing, Golf Story.
Oh yeah. So I have never played this game, and I heard a bunch of mixed reviews about this because I think some people were really excited about this because it has a lot of. My understanding is that it has a lot of JRPG elements, but then some people don't like it because it is actually also a golfing game.
There is a lot of, so as one might, assume, there's a lot of golf in this game.
So I don't think that I have ever enjoyed a golf game.
No, no, you have. You have.
I have?
Kirby's Dream Course.
Okay, true. Kirby's, that's a miniature golf game though, to be fair. So is this more like Tiger Woods or is this more like Kirby's?
This is more like Kirby's. It's more like, there's like a Mario, a Super Mario golf game, I think, on the Super Nintendo or maybe the Game Boy. I'm forgetting where it was that, that this is very reminiscent of, but it's your basic, you press a button to start your meter, you press a button to stop the power, you press a button to choose the angle of your hit, and then you swing. So, you know, three-click type of swing. There's a set of, I mean, there's all the golf clubs that you'd assume, the woods, irons, the chip, putter. There's kind of nominal wind resistance and slope of the terrain mechanics that are in there. And it's this 2D top-down golf game.
It's 2D?
Yeah.
It's, oh, interesting.
It's it looks a lot like it. I mean, it looks a lot like a Super Nintendo era JRPG. You know, it's pixel art and pretty pretty simple pixel art too. Not, you know, it zooms in for effect. You know, it zooms in and the characters do get really blocky when it zooms in, and then it zooms back out and things look smoother. So it has that kind of Super Nintendo Final Fantasy look to it. Mm-hmm. The cool thing about it is that the puzzles in the game, where it's like, oh, we need to open this locked gate, I wonder how we do that.
Like, you have to hit a golf ball down a hill into the lock.
That is exactly what happens.
Oh, really?
Yeah. okay. Outside of the actual courses, when you're just walking around the towns and the world, you can...
Oh, so there is like an overmap JRPG style.
Oh, yeah. You're going up to townspeople and pressing A to talk to them, and they're giving you quests to do. The quests golf all have quests. To do with golf. Yeah. And so, you know, in order to, in that scenario that you outlined, you can, when you're in the overworld, you can tee up anywhere. So you press the button and he just lays the ball down and you can start just, you know, hitting the ball somewhere.
That is a criminal offense here. Like, if I were to just bust out with my golf clubs, I don't know golf clubs, and start swinging and breaking like windows at stores and stuff.
I mean, this is the magic fantasy world that Golf Story takes place in, where everyone is obsessed with golf, by the way. Like, every single town you go to has its own course, and it's part of their culture. And, you know, you go to, like, that's the amazing desert course, or you go to the snow course.
It's like Mario World almost.
Yeah, and every world has its own little sub-golf culture. And
this sounds like almost like the way that Professor Layton Village is. Everyone is just super into puzzles.
It is very similar. We're like, oh, this is the core tenet of your entire universe, but it just happens to be golf. I'm not finished with it yet, and I think my main criticism of it is that I think it just goes on a little bit too long. Because I do feel like I have a really good sense of the mechanics, and, you know, like I said, they're not super deep, but they're very charming, and it's highly satisfying when you're able to take a look at the wind and read the type of club you should have. I think, like most sports games, I fell off of golf games after they got too complicated.
Right.
This is not a simulation game. It's an RPG where the action is golf.
How is the story? How is the story of A Golf Story?
The story is actually pretty amusing. You play as someone whose dad taught him how to golf, and then he kind of lost touch with it. He didn't really keep up with golf that much. And after your dad dies or disappears, I don't know. I forget what happens.
You have to rediscover your father through golf.
You're kind of, because you bust out his old clubs, and then you start working your way up into the pro circuit, because you're just not, the character isn't happy with his life. Like, he has an ex-girlfriend that he's basically breaking up with and is trying to, or maybe actually it's his ex-wife. And
is this what The Legend of Bagger Vance is about?
I mean, there's not as much, you know, like, magical brown skin person in this game Bagger Vance.
Okay, good. Well, that's nice.
I mean, to be fair, actually, the coach in this game is a lot like, the coach in this game is a lot like the coach in, like, the Happy Gilmore.
That's movie. The classic and only golf movie I've ever seen.
Yeah. So maybe there's going to be a little bit there, but thankfully they've avoided that so far. The writing is actually pretty amusing. There's a lot of kind of internal monologue when you're talking to characters where your character is like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I guess I'll do it anyway. Sure. It's a charming little game, and I actually do find it highly satisfying to, you know, make a long chip in shot from, you know, the bunker, and it actually goes in, and, you know, you're going through the courses. So I think I'm towards the end of it, but it was a surprise on the Switch, and it was really nice on the Switch as well, because you can just kind of play a hole or two and then put it in sleep mode and come back to it later on.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer that golf is the worst sport ever invented by man, but
even compared to bowling.
Yes, because there's an environmental impact to golf.
That's true.
Whereas bowling, yeah, like you could fit a lot of lanes in one thing, right? Like the amount of water you got to waste on a fucking golf course is absurd.
So maybe if we built our society around golf, the world would just be a golf course.
I think
we
that's probably a good idea. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I think what's funny is we were talking during the gamies as well, the storification of sports games.
Yeah.
This is the opposite end of the AAA, single A spectrum.
That's true. That's
from
true.
Like FIFA. But it really can, you know, in my opinion, bring back my interest in some of those sports titles, right? Because mm-hmm. you're infusing it with JRPG elements.
Totally.
Cool. Well, my next game is not a sports game, unless the sport that you're really into is self-flagellation.
Oh, yeah.
And that is Getting Over It by Bennett Foddy. Have you played this yet?
I haven't played it yet. I've just watched people play it.
So I have this on Steam. So we have family sharing. So you should get over it already. This
and,
is
and
a game.
Get under it.
Get under it. If you're not familiar with Getting Over It or Bennett Foddy's work, this is a he's an infamous indie game designer. Getting Over It is a very challenging experience in which you play a naked man inside of a cast iron pot with nothing but a hammer that you can swing to fling yourself and climb over what is essentially a massive obstacle course.
Hmm.
I saw a speedrun of this game complete this game in 4 minutes and 21 seconds.
Oh, so close to 420.
I know, right? I have played almost 2 hours of Getting Over It, and I have moved maybe like one quarter of my way through the game.
Oh my God.
Because it's very fucking hard. And the great thing about this is, so while you're playing this ridiculous, what is essentially like a physics game, Bennett Foddy will speak over, the designer will speak over your experience and tell you certain things. And everything he talks about is essentially pontifications on difficulty and challenge and reward and giving up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he reminds you really early on, you know, it's okay to give up. If you need a break, just go ahead and walk away. And there's this great like double play, right? Mm-hmm. Where part of his words are encouraging because he's saying it in this really calm way of like, you know, it's okay, you could keep going, you can stop whenever you want, you can take a break. And then the other hand, it feels like the ultimate troll.
Because he's just condescending to you.
Yeah, because it's like someone who's being like really nice, but knowing that you're fucking up, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's, you know, you can stop if you want. Like, it's fine. I'm not going to judge you, you know? But I feel like he knows you're judging yourself.
Yeah.
You know? And even the dialogue of what he's talking about is about that.
Yeah. I love his games. And I think the unapologetic approach to it is good.
Yeah.
It's worth noting that I remember reading this when he released it, but on his website, he just kind of has single pages for the games that he released. And the description for Getting Over It is, I created this game for a certain kind of person to hurt them.
Yeah, it's pretty great. When I was, so there's this part in the beginning, it's called, this first phase, I think it's called The Devil's Chimney, which just gives you a good idea of what this game feels like. And it is this brutal part where you have to fling yourself like through this tunnel, and it's so fucking hard, and I have such a hard time every time I get to that particular spot. I got over it.
Oh, man.
So I got past it, and I was like, yes, and I posted on Twitter. I was like, I fucking did it. I got through this first major segment. Literally, like 30 seconds later, I'm climbing the second part. I fling myself over and drop down all the way to the very beginning of the game.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, are you joking me? And then I hear Bennett Foddy's words being like, ooh, that hurts.
And you're like, God, and that's when I threw my computer out the window.
God damn it, Bennett Foddy, like, what? You're a monster. It feels really good, though. You know, like, it is, I like, in the same way that I like going back to Dark Souls sometimes, or some of the more, like, brutally difficult games, there is something really calming about facing the challenge of something like Getting Over It for just a quick session of like 20, 30 minutes, and then being like, all right, that's enough. I've suffered enough. I'm done. I'm going to go and do something else.
Does it actually save where you got to? Like, if you quit the game out, do you pick up where you left off, or do you start at
the
beginning?
No, you'll pick up where you left off. Yeah, so you don't have to do everything in one run. It will save your your progress.
It saves it both ways.
It'll auto-save your failures as well. So you're not going to be able to, like, alt-tab out quick enough before your fall.
I love it. It's also a great game. I mean, it's nice that it came out in this environment of being able to watch other people play it, because it's just hilarious.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I also should say the philosophy and the conversation that is speaking over it is both making fun of that. Like, it's in a way, it's making fun of Jonathan Blow's The Witness, like, pseudo-philosophy, while also partaking in it in a really smart way. And I think the game deserves enough recognition just even for that component of it, which I think is really easy to just throw out the window and say, oh, this is just a funny navel-gazy commentary on difficulty. But I think he's actually engaging with that concept of challenge and difficulty in a really interesting way.
I mean, I think that is... Bennett Foddy is actually a weird...
Australian
kind of echo of, well, he is, but he's a weird echo of Jonathan Blow in that way, like almost through a shadowy mirror. Like he's kind of like he's kind
which
of like,
is the evil one. I think we know the answer to
oh
that,
we know actually. The answer, but it's almost like a court jester of he's making a really good point about things, but by doing it in a very like irreverent and silly way, but actually the stuff that he does is pretty deep. But he masks it under this veneer of ridiculousness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should say, Goragoa and Getting Over It both came out like mid-December.
Yeah.
So you're not going to really see it on anybody's Games of the Year list. But I think, you know, if you were to relook at, say, the top 10s for people's lists, I would probably put both of these games on my top 10.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I'll swing back over to me. Let me talk about a game that I play... like Call of Duty.
Okay. Is it Call of Duty?
AKA like a racist 12-year-old. No. Splatoon 2.
Oh, yes.
I fire up Splatoon 2 and go straight into the multiplayer. And I was actually doing some traveling recently. And I was like, well, I'm kind of away from internet for a sec. Let me look at the single player. And I was like, oh, there's like a whole game back here. I never bothered to play it.
Yeah.
And I think that was the same case for Splatoon 1. And so I was just digging into the other stuff and walking around the Inkopolis, and I was like, man, there's like a whole other thing rather than just the multiplayer lobby that I never knew about. And it made me like the game even more. But I think Splatoon 2 is a really good game, probably held back only by the fact that Splatoon 1 was such a weird surprise, and Splatoon 2 is more of what you loved / hated about Splatoon 1.
Yeah. I really love, you know, Splatoon and Splatoon 2 are both of those games that I really love that exists, but I don't find myself going back to it as often as I wish I did. And it's largely because I just don't think I will ever understand the controls. Like, I've just never gotten to that point. I feel like I need a personal coach. Because do you play with the Joy-Cons exclusively?
Basically I do it two ways. One, if I'm actually at home or if I'm in a place where I can just kind of sit and play a game, I'll definitely detach the Joy-Cons and play. If I am on the go and I can't detach the Joy-Cons, I can still play it, but I'll choose different weapons that don't really require precise controls. And then play it that way. So if I have a gun that I'm actually shooting, I'll definitely use the Joy-Cons. If I'm using the roller, then it's a much more territory control type of mode, and I don't actually need the aiming as much.
I see. So you switch back and forth depending on what your
play style is. I switch back and forth.
I see what you did there.
Yeah.
I feel like I really need to.
What is it about the controls that is?
It feels like the dead zone. Like, it just feels really like imprecise in the way that I've heard the gameplay described when you're using the individual Joy-Con separated from the Switch, is that you should feel as though the right Joy-Con that you're using to aim is like a mouse.
Yeah.
And pointing right at the screen. And I've just never grokked it yet. You know, I've seen videos where people are trying to justify that experience. And their movement speed, the reaction time, the ability to like flip 360 and fire at someone else is impeccable. And I am 100% certain that that is the best way to play if you're trying to be competitive with like the shooters, right? But I've never unlocked it. Like, I love the world. I love playing those games and winning and feeling good when I get kills and stuff. But it feels like there's this really this really hard wall that I hit that I'm just not used to hitting in competitive multiplayer games. Because, not to talk myself up, but I think I'm actually pretty decent at competitive multiplayer games, but I suck at Splatoon 2.
Yeah, it's different because it's unique, and I think that's what you're pointing out, because it's not really like anything else out there, and so it's this singular skill that is basically only applicable to Splatoon. And it takes a little bit to sort of learn. I will say that once I finally leveled up to get into the ranked mode if I wanted to, and you can tell there's a huge skill difference there, and even the guns that people use are different, because and they're very attuned to that precise aiming that you're describing, whereas, you know, this time of year in the normal lobby matches, you can just clean up because people are just messing around, or people have just gotten the game for Christmas or whatever, and you're just harvesting.
I mean, maybe I should go back and play it then.
It's actually a pretty good time to play it, because there are a lot of people playing it right now. And they continue to add to it. It's also just a different style of game, where there's that map rotation that is set within the game. You know, you don't get to pick what maps you're going to, and it varies day by day, which in some ways is annoying, but in some ways, again, is like a unique thing that unites the community around a central experience, which can be a problem with multiplayer shooters, you know, as they get fragmented as the time goes on.
I mean, you look at PUBG, where there's one map that's publicly available, two if you count the test server, you know? So fuck it, don't complain.
Yeah, I mean,
this is the new era.
Well, it's also, you just get to know the maps better. It also, I mean, the game is just, it's just chock full of like attitude and its own little subculture of, you know, Squid Kids. They do so much work around the world building in this game that is a multiplayer shooter.
Right.
And I really like it. I think it's a really charming game, and I remember why I played so much of the first game too, when I go back to it.
Nice. You know, we've mentioned like a bunch of Switch games already. That's kind of crazy.
I think this year was the year of the Switch for sure.
Year of the Switch. Okay, so I'm going to name one last game, but first I want to mention, I just feel like Cuphead wasn't in my top three list, but I love that game.
Yes.
Gosh, Neo came out this year. Never finished it. Super cool game though. Yep. Night in the Woods. Awesome game. But the one I want to mention last, and I also didn't finish, mostly because I got distracted and then I lent it out to friends, and now I think it's gone. I don't know who has it. That is Horizon Zero Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
From Guerrilla Games.
Yeah.
We did mention it during our Gameys.
As the prettiest game. Because
it won the prettiest game, which I still think it deserves. I'm really glad that when we think about Dark Souls and the way that
and we
that
do
has, well, you know, we talked about this quite a bit, right? Last year, when we did our looking forward, Horizon Zero Dawn was one of the games that we mentioned showed a lot of potential. And one of the reasons it showed a lot of potential, well, I remember thinking, you and I having the conversation about, this game doesn't look that great. Okay, dino robots, whatever. We already have Dinobots. Do we need this? Whatever, right? But then we saw the first gameplay footage from, I think it might have been E3, but maybe it was later in the year, where they showed her fighting fighting like a larger T-Rex creature and binding it with the ropes and really dodging out of the way and having a much more, clearly much more gameplay that was influenced by the Dark Souls series and like frame rate and, you know, dodging things and really focused on that level of precision when it comes to fighting. And while I don't think Horizon Zero Dawn was 100% successful, and especially in how they laid out how many enemies you're fighting at one time and the sort of minute-to-minute gameplay, I do think that it was really cool to see this genre generally, like the open-world genre, not give in to following a sort of the same trite formula. I think you're seeing it in other open-world games too. I mean, you know, caveat that I work at Ubisoft, but I think AC Origins does a pretty good job of also updating some of the normal open world stuff. And I think Horizon and Zelda does as well, of course. Horizon comes in behind Zelda for sure, but I do think it deserves a lot of attention and recognition for, I think, what is a really strong game, really strong voice acting, gorgeously put together, and a pretty cool story. Again, I haven't finished it, but that's one I think that was definitely on my list and definitely something I want to finish now that I've got some time going into this year.
I haven't played it either, but the stuff that I do know about it and the stuff that I've read and heard people talk about is I was impressed with how many people had good things to say about the story. And how, I mean, you know, it's a sci-fi story. It's a post-apocalypse type of story, but it seemed like there were some clever things that they did with the technology and the, you know, ancient civilization that created it. It seemed like people enjoyed that, which is cool. Cause it could, it could be something that could easily just spiral off into generic sci-fi-dom.
Yeah. And it's also remarkably diverse, like racially diverse. There's a lot of women. There's a lot of people of color in the game, like NPCs. And the game justifies that diversity in its story. Like they think about it, right? It's not just, oh, we need to put people in here because it's like a checkbox, right? Mm-hmm. Like it makes sense within the universe. And it's really cool to see that sort of in action. I think a lot of times, especially with sci-fi, you end up seeing a lot of like, this is a far-flung future where everyone's still super white. You know? it's kind of cool for them to take like, you know, the Star Trek approach or something, right? Yeah. Where like, oh, there's a lot of diversity and that is partially why the future is interesting, right? Like there's different cultures and different people and things are weird and there's stories to be told in the future setting that are about the real world today. And it's cool to see that done at such a scale because I think we do see it in a lot of video games. You know, some of the indie games in particular, like Tacoma, right, is playing around with that is a very contained sci-fi story set in the future. But it's cool for to see people do that on a larger scale in like the AAA space, where I actually don't think that sci-fi has been done all that well in the past, except for maybe like Mass Effect.
Yeah, yeah. And after this year, we don't speak of Mass Effect anymore.
Yeah, that game is dead to us.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny, on a side note, one of the reasons why that game has been on my mind recently is because I'm continuing to read through the Dark Tower books by Stephen King for the first time. And I'm on like the third book and it starts to really get into a lot of the stuff that Horizon seems to get into where it's like, oh, this is actually thousands upon thousands of years in the future and something really bad happened back in the day. And now and this old technology has kind of taken on a life of its own. And it's like, oh, man, I should really get into Horizon again.
Yeah. Oh, man, they should really make a gunslinger video game.
Fuck. I mean, Rockstar can only work on one thing at a time. Okay, I will finish up here. Like you, I'll throw in a couple that I didn't get to talk about. Cuphead, obviously. I think any other year Cuphead would have been in our top three, but it's just it's been a ridiculous year. A game that I think it actually came out in 2016, but I came to it this year, early on in the year, was Hyper Light Drifter. I really liked that game a lot, and it was just something I played in 2017 that made a big impression. Mm-hmm. And let's see what else. Oh, Mario and Rabbids, that made a big impression on me this year because it just came out of nowhere and it hit that sweet spot of that XCOM sweet spot that I really wanted. It's funny because the stuff that I sometimes get fatigued of in XCOM is actually the more hardcore stuff where you're managing resources and building out your base. Like I actually like the moment-to-moment battling, and Mario and Rabbids brought that moment-to-moment battling. It like that's almost the entire game, and it brought some interesting stuff to it around the like melee combat rather than just shooting, which I thought was pretty cool.
Totally.
It also expanded the Mario universe in scary ways that we're still gripping with, but that's a podcast for another day.
I mean, Odyssey I think does that more than Rabbids for sure.
It's been a tumultuous year for the Mushroom Kingdom in general.
It really has.
Last one I'll talk about in any depth is What Remains of Edith Finch.
Also Annapurna Pictures.
Yeah, that was
or Interactive.
Yeah, that was a very, it was early on, I think. And I know I definitely played it pretty early in the year. But I think it did it did a lot with the genre that it's in, which, you know, we kind of refer to either mockingly or maybe in a reclamation version of walking simulators. I think it told a story that really made use of the video game medium as a whole, where we joked around about, yeah, you're a shark rolling down a hill at a certain point, but you are. And it does that to create this sense of what, you know, how strange and fantastical memories are. And
Well, I think that right there is exactly what makes this game interesting to me. Like, I, you know, I'm not as I recall, I wasn't the biggest fan just because I feel like I'm a little bit over walking simulators. Mm-hmm. But the way that like memory and specifically like storytelling about family mm-hmm. takes on like a magical feeling. Yeah. But like that's sort of that is what happens as people tell these fantastical stories about, you know, their childhood or their great grandparents.
Yeah, it is something like there is an almost like Murakami type of sensibility to it where.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're not quite sure what is real, but it all seems very realistic, and even the magical stuff has its own logic to it. I think even walking around the levels was very cool. You know, what it means to go back to your house and what that metaphor is as you walk through it. I think that the acting and the writing was really good in it. The visual metaphors that they use, I think it's a great example of that sort of game. It doesn't necessarily push the boundaries of that game in a way that like the Fulbright Company does, or even something like Firewatch maybe.
I recall that you and I both liked What Remains of Edith Finch significantly more than Tacoma, right?
I think I do. I think what Tacoma does might, again, you know, might expand the boundaries a little bit more, but the story and the experience and how I felt playing it, I felt more strongly playing Edith Finch than Tacoma.
Do you think that this is the best walking simulator?
It is the best walking
scenario. I mean, it's a silly question, but we're at this unique time, right, where there's few enough that we could sort of stack rank them. Like, if you were to suggest someone play a walking simulator, this genre, right, like, there's only a handful that you could recommend.
Right.
I think What Remains of Edith, I love Gone Home. I think that is definitely one I would recommend people play, but in terms of taking that genre forward a little bit, I think What Remains of Edith Finch is really interesting from that perspective.
Yeah, and it tells a similar story of a very
Pacific Northwest house.
Yeah, exactly. It's all walking simulators. The hub of walking simulators is the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah,
but I mean, I was really impressed with it, and it's I think you're right. It is one of those things where it might be the best that genre has to offer, and at least it's a good introduction to it because it's approachable. You know, you don't want to jump right into even something like, even something like Gone Home is a little bit different because you might get overwhelmed by all of the different things you can interact with. But Edith Finch is a pretty linear thing and tells a story and with metaphors that is nice and is interactive. And I really appreciated what it did.
If I can't pick up a duck, though, I'm not interested.
I was thinking about that, whether there, as a nod, you know, whether there is a duck in there. They should just put a duck everywhere in
any walking simulator. I agree. I think every walking sim should have a duck. Tacoma should have a duck. Was there a duck in Tacoma?
There has to have been, right? Maybe inside one of the... The funny thing is, do you think the next... we'll talk about this next week, probably, but the next Campo Santo game, you're going to open up a mummy's tomb and you're going to find a duck in there.
I hope so. Like, oh, they apparently they worship ducks, not cats. Interesting. Before we end on Edith Finch, you were also a big fan of The Unfinished Swan, which was Giant Sparrow's first game.
Yeah.
So I think it is kind of cool to see, now that they have two games under their belt, it's like, oh, this is a studio that we can pay attention to. And, you know, their next game, I presume, is going to be, you know, even cooler.
Yeah. And it was quite different, too, from... Edith Finch. So there's range inside of the genre that they like to work in a similar way that Tacoma and Gone Home did. So I think it's cool to see people thrive within, within the genre that they are experts in.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. Well, that was a lot of stuff. I mean, it wasn't even everything. So we'll still be like unpacking 2017 well into 2018, I feel.
Oh, yeah. But that was a year. I have to try to get myself to finish some of these games.
I know. We're interested in what you played that maybe didn't make your top three, but are still standout games of 2017. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address if you want to get in touch.
Oops. And experiencepoints.net is our refrigerator with all of our goodies. We have hundreds of podcast episodes, literally.
Yeah, literally hundreds.
Literally hundreds of podcast episodes. They're still good, though. They're still tasty.
Yeah.
So come on by, tell your friends, rate our fridge.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. If you are hearing this at the end of the year, have a happy new year, and we will be talking to you in 2018.
Ciao.
every time.